Welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Marlborough, Hudson, Harvard, Stowe, and Bolton. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. This program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashland, Bolton, and Harvard, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the Marlborough Hudson Community Advocate, July 10th edition, the Harvard Press, July 3rd edition, and we still don't have the Independent of Stowe and Bolton. They must still be on summer vacation. This is Bob Brady reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. I'm going to start us off with a public service announcement. The Worcester Public Library announced the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th, which is past, through August 15th. Created by Tactile Images, the exhibit uses patented technology that transforms iconic works of art into three-dimensional tactile renderings, allowing visitors to experience visual information through touch. The exhibit's design, in part, makes visual art more accessible to the blind or visually impaired. The exhibit, Seven Art Movements, examines the evolution of history's art movements through tactile reproductions of works by renowned artists including Leonardo da Vinci, Johannes Vermeer, and Vincent van Gogh. It also explores stylistic characteristics of the Renaissance, Baroque, Neoclassicism, Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, Art Nouveau, and Expressionism. The exhibition features seven tactile images, each paired with a corresponding fine art print. The Worcester Talking Book Library is committed to ensuring that everyone has access to educational and cultural experiences, said Leanne Hooley, head of WTBL. This exhibit offers a unique opportunity for individuals who are blind or visually impaired to engage with art in a meaningful way, while helping sighted visitors gain a deeper appreciation for accessible designs and inclusive programming. Once again, the Worcester Public Library announced the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th through August 15th. And now I've got some articles from the Marlborough Hudson Community Advocate. Participate in Hudson Restaurant Week this July, by Evan Walsh. In February, the Hudson Downtown Business Improvement District introduced its inaugural Hudson Restaurant Week, 7 days of celebrating and supporting local eateries that contribute to the town's vibrant and award-winning downtown. It was a huge success for local business, with restaurants reporting increased foot traffic and greater enthusiasm for local dining and for patrons who leveraged deals and explored what Hudson had to offer. It was so successful that the Hudson Downtown Business Improvement District is bringing it back from July 12th to July 18th. We have a lot of restaurants, and all of them are invested in making sure everyone's experience is top-notch, said Richard Braga, the administrators for the Hudson Downtown Business Improvement District. We have a lot of creative menus and people putting a lot of energy and effort into what they offer. During Restaurant Week, participating restaurants, cafes, bakeries, breweries, and specialty food businesses throughout downtown Hudson will offer special menus, featured items, chef-inspired creations, and limited-time summer offerings. While the February Restaurant Week was perfect, The summertime event brings new opportunities. Different ingredients are in season, summer menus have been released, and now that the weather has warmed up, outdoor dining is in full swing. It's the perfect opportunity to revisit favorite spots, discover a new local gem, and experience everything the downtown Hudson dining scene has to offer. We have a good number of restaurants, and they all have different offerings. We're fortunate that we have it all. All the restaurants offer something unique, said Braga. We're at the point now that people come to Hudson, then decide what they want to have when they come here. The options are many. Cafe 641, 45 Main Street, T.C. Lando's, 127 Main Street, and the Firehouse Catering and More, 5 High Street, are participating, joining Rail Trail Flatbread Company, 33 Main Street, Main Street Bagel Factory, 51 Main Street, Harvard Suite Boutique, 25 South Street, The Evergreen Room, 12 Main Street, and Less Than Greater Than, 28 Main Street. Options also include New City Micro Creamery, 28 Main Street, Finnegan's Pub, 25 South Street, Malahi's Cheese Shop, 162 Main Street, Welly's Restaurant, 23 Main Street, Amaya Martini Bar and Restaurant, 176 Main Street, and Kith and Kin, 38 to 40 Washington Street. More details are available at discoverhudson.org/restaurant-week-2026. Over the last 15-plus years, there's been a real transformation to our downtown. Prior to that, there were significant vacancies, and it really wasn't very active. We're so lucky to have all these restaurants, and it's really been transformational over the last 15 or so years, said Braga. The glue holding the community together. This Hudson heroine helps those dealing with food insecurity, by Lainey Halsey. Dr. Patricia Kelly Luato is at the heart of many of Hudson's volunteer initiatives. For over 20 years, Luato has served with the Hudson Community Food Pantry, providing expertise from over three decades working in nutrition. To commend Luato for her years of dedicated service to the community, State Representative Kate Hogan nominated her for the Commonwealth Heroine Award. The recognition, presented by the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women, seeks to honor women for their contributions across Massachusetts, even if they don't often get the limelight. Dr. Pat Luato is treasured by the Hudson community for her efforts to make Hudson a better place and to make a difference in the lives of her Hudson neighbors, Hogan wrote the community advocate. Hogan specifically highlighted Luato's work in making the Hudson Community Food Pantry, which also serves the towns of Berlin and Bolton, as efficient and effective as possible. Luato was humbled by the recognition and made a point to recognize the other volunteers who have worked alongside her. For her, volunteerism is a natural part of her life. The impulse to help others goes back to her upbringing, she said, when she made herself available to help others at church, school, and within her local community. I was taught to follow the golden rule, do unto others as others do unto you. It's just kind of what I learned to do growing up, Luato said. After moving to Hudson in the 1970s, Luato and her husband George fell in love with the town and decided that it was where they wanted to stay. We raised our family here. We got to know people, Luato said. We enjoyed the fact that it was diverse and especially enjoyed seeing the transformation over the years. Part of Hudson's transformation has included evolving from a traditional mill town into a revitalized and growing community. That shift includes a greater need for food assistance. Luato is a professor emeritus at Framingham State University, focusing on food and nutrition. The former director of the John Stalker Institute, Luato, also worked as a dietitian and has a background in food safety. "I love food. It's who I am. It's my career," Luato said. "I have a real special place in my heart for anybody who has food insecurity." Since 2019, food insecurity levels in Massachusetts have jumped from 19 to 40%, a statistic that only adds to the importance of Luato's work. As a director with the Hudson Community Food Pantry, she helps coordinate with the Greater Boston Food Bank. "I hope that I have been able to provide the pantry with an understanding of food insecurity at the state level and how it impacts us at the individual community level," Luato said. She attributes much of the pantry's success to the volunteers who unload 5,000-pound food shipments, label and place all of the items, ensure food and safety standards, and much more. "Their volunteerism is extraordinary," Luato said. "These are people who are there every single Tuesday and Saturday morning. I mean, they really consider this to be their mission, to provide for the clients that come to the food pantry." Luato previously served as chair of the Hudson Cultural Council. She now serves as secretary to the Hudson Cultural Alliance. "I think there's so many benefits that art and culture can provide to a community," Luato said. "It gives us the opportunity to gather together as a community in the same place and to experience the music or theater that's being provided." After decades of volunteering, Luato believes the Commonwealth Heroines Award recognizes something much greater than an individual achievement. The Commission on the Status of Women says that it's women who are the glue holding the community together, Luato said. There were 147 recipients of the Commonwealth Heroine Award, but there could have been double or triple that amount. For others looking to give back in their own communities, Luato encourages people to simply take a look around. "I think you can volunteer with the people that you know," Luato said. "Everybody knows somebody who is in need of a meal, telephone call, or a visit." I'm with some pretty amazing people. Marlboro's Barbara Fenby pushes for change, helps others, by Lena Halsey. Barbara Babs Fenby laughs when people call her a badass. But after more than 60 years as a social worker, decades of activism, and a commitment to advocating for people on the margins of society, that description suits her. Her work recently earned her recognition as a Commonwealth heroine after being nominated by State Representative Danielle Gregoire. Fenby graduated from the University of California, Los Angeles, in 1962 and has been a social worker ever since. Her early work involved adoptions, emergency family interventions, and dealing with cases of child abuse. "The thing about social workers is that you have a variety of ways to live out your moral values," Fenby said. "So it shifted from time to time, and in the later part of my career, I was working with seriously mentally ill folks as state hospitals closed." Fenby's core belief is that every client is an equal. "Any one of them could have been you or me," Fenby said, "and you have to treat them as real people. At some point in their lives, they were loved or not loved, but it doesn't matter. At the moment, they are your equals." The most rewarding part of her work is seeing people reclaim their own lives. It's knowing somebody at their worst, and then a year or two later, running into them at the supermarket, and they'll say, "Hi, Barb." You say to yourself that whatever else in my life I've done, there's one thing I help make right, she said. But Fenby's work doesn't end there. She enjoys being a gorilla in the bureaucracy, using her position to jockey the system towards social change. From the streets of D.C. to the West Bank, Fenby has demonstrated that an individual can make an impact. She recounts a protest, one of many demonstrations she's attended over the years, in the 60s, where she was tear-gassed in the nation's capital. One always hopes that the last protest you're in will be the last protest, but essentially, times change, and you find yourself on the battle lines again, Fenby said. In 2022, she took a solo trip to Israel and Jordan and stayed at a peace hospital in the West Bank. There, she witnessed the inhumanity of the conflict firsthand. While most people take global reports at face value, Fenby insisted on digging deeper. Even if I trust that person, I still have the sense that I have to do my own research, Fenby said. I have to understand for myself. I have to intellectually know about it, and I have to experience it in some way. When Fenby learned that she had been nominated for the Commonwealth Heroine Award, she originally wanted to fly under the radar. That changed, though, after gathering with the other heroines. Upon reflection and upon meeting the other women who were nominated and reading their history, I said, I'm glad that I've been nominated because I'm with some pretty amazing people. Despite a lifetime spent confronting conflict, Fenby strives for moments of connection when people remember what brings them together. She sees that every year on the 4th of July. I always hope that the joy that we felt on the 4th of July carries over, Fenby said. I mean, did anybody care what anybody's politics were? We were all out there flying the flag and happy to be having a beer with somebody. Gregoire wrote in a statement to the Community Advocate, everyone I know wants to be like Babs, just a badass lady who continues to throw everything she has at this life and into the lives of the people around her. Now let's listen to a public service announcement, and then I'll be back with more news.
Would you like to hear news from Bolton, Harvard, Hudson, and Marlborough that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 3 p.m.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:17. I'm going to continue with the Marlborough Hudson Community Advocate. Hudson opens new dog park, ready for canines of all kinds, by Paul Hopkins. July 1st was among the dog days of summer in Hudson as temperatures climbed into the high 90s and a heat advisory took effect. It was sweltering. But the summertime humidity couldn't stop the first official users of the Hudson Dog Park from converging on the new facility at 529 Main Street. It's really cool, said Roberta Oley of Hudson, who brought her 9-year-old golden retriever, Murph, on opening day. I had been to some of the meetings that they'd had through the years to try and get it going, and so it's really nice to see it actually here. Oley said Murph likes to run and play with the other dogs, and she expects many to frequent the park. As she spoke, a family arrived with 3 more canines. Director of Recreation Stephen Santos said there were 2 major goals: make the park accessible in all areas and keep it as natural as possible, so there's lots of shade. Most of the space is shaded by a variety of trees. The dog park is partially funded through a $250,000 grant from the Stanton Foundation, with additional funds from the town's Community Preservation Committee. The project could have cost around $280,000, but Santos says he expects that the $90,000 or more of that will be returned to the CPC. We opened on time and under budget, he said. There are large and small dog areas in the nearly 15,000-square-foot park with benches in each area. Several picnic tables are designed to be wheelchair accessible, and the designers created a few interesting obstacles for dogs to climb on, like large rocks and tree trunks. you have to go back to 2016 to see the first mention of a dog park project in Hudson. A community outreach effort in 2018 showed lots of interest in an off-leash dog park, and the idea was incorporated into the town's next master plan. Hudson Public Schools considering facial recognition-based security system by Evan Walsh. Hudson Public Schools is exploring implementing an upgraded security system that would leverage facial recognition, among other measures, to secure buildings and protect students. Superintendent Brian Reagan detailed the plans before the school committee on June 23rd. The district is finalizing a contract with Single Wire, an emergency mass communication system, to license software to help inform students, staff, and parents. It provides all kinds of features we didn't have before. It's not only a back-and-forth communication system, but it can be used on-site or even off-site. It's much more nimble than using our existing communication system for something like that, said Reagan. The system would have the ability to overtake network systems within the building in the event of an emergency, including laptop screens and the school's PA system. With Single Wire, staff could also leverage panic buttons on their phones in an emergency. In addition to GPS capabilities that can accurately pinpoint a person down to the room, Single Wire can do enhanced visitor registration sign-in at the district's schools. Using iPads, visitors can scan their state-issued IDs, and the software can compare that photo to a local database. Facial recognition software may be used. If we had a parent or community member that wasn't allowed in one of our buildings or our grounds, we can have a no trespass on that individual. We can enter that in our own database and we'll flag if that person enters, said Reagan. The district is still evaluating options, and an update is expected in July. The community advocate will provide updates about the decision when it is made. And now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Press. Landfill capping will force DPW move Upper Depot Field best option, Dunbar says, by John Osborne. The town must cap the former Harvard landfill, and the work will force the Department of Public Works headquarters and the transfer station off their current site, Town Administrator Dawn Dunbar told the Select Board Tuesday night. The state could hand Harvard an administrative consent order at any time, Dunbar said, because of PFAS contamination on nearby properties. Such an order would set a fixed deadline for the capping, forcing the town to act quickly. Capping will likely wipe out most or all of the current transfer station, along with the DPW salt shed, fuel island, and storage shed. Dunbar proposed relocating the DPW to Upper Depot Field, an athletic field next to the former landfill, then shifting the transfer station into the space currently occupied by the DPW buildings, avoiding the lengthy process of re-permitting a transfer station on a new site. There's a lot of moving parts right now, Dunbar told the board, but I think the next step in this process is to have DPW Director Eric Ryder into the next meeting to discuss what recapping the landfill looks like. The plan would also cost the town Upper Depot Field and possibly Lower Depot Field, both on Depot Road and key to the town's youth sports program. That potential loss weighed on Select Board member Eve Wittenberg. The town has worked hard to add fields for sports and recreational use, she said, and losing one now, when Harvard is already short of what it needs, felt like a step backward. A possible fix has emerged. A parcel at 57 Old Mill Road, next to the land the town already owns, has come on the market. Board members said the site, if wetlands there prove suitable for development, could replace Upper Depot Field. The board voted 4-0, with member Kara Miner absent, to authorize up to $2,500 to map wetlands on the Old Mill Road property, then voted 4-0 again to direct Dunbar to negotiate a memorandum of understanding with the landowner and bring it back for approval. The memorandum would buy time for the board to negotiate a purchase and present it to town meeting in the fall. Ryder will recommend a plan for capping the former landfill with cost estimates at the select board's July 21st meeting. Select board rules dog dangerous after May biting incident by Marty Green. At a June 24th hearing, the select board declared a 3-year-old German Shepherd named Ranger met the legal standard of a dangerous dog, having seriously bitten a woman in May. Board members also voted to require the dog's owners, William and Jackie Stevenson, of Warren Avenue, to take a number of measures, both to keep the dog secure and to correct its behavior. Acton resident Susan Pinsky testified she was working at the Stevenson's house on May 2nd, carrying things to a storage loft in the barn. Ranger and another dog were shut in stalls in the barn. She said Ranger somehow escaped from the stall and knocked her down, biting her arms as she tried to protect her face and throat. Her skin and arm muscles were ripped, and she was bleeding profusely. Pinsky said she thinks she would have died if the owners had not heard her calls for help. Photographs of the injuries were submitted with her complaint, and select board member Kara Miner called them horrific. The board noted Ranger had bitten Pinsky once before and had also bitten a snowplow contractor on the leg and nipped a visiting child on the hand, although no complaints had been filed in those cases. Under Harvard's bylaws, a dog is deemed dangerous if it attacks and injures a person or domestic animal without justification. It may also be deemed dangerous if a reasonable person would believe its behavior poses an imminent threat of such an attack. The vote to declare the Stevenson's dog dangerous was 4-1. Eve Wittenberg voted no on that motion, based on her experience with some difficult dogs she had owned in the past. But she later joined the other board members in a unanimous decision as to the measures the Stevensons are required to take. Many of those measures are set by state law, Massachusetts General Laws, Chapter 140, Section 157. A dog that has been declared dangerous must be muzzled and on a strong leash except when it is in the house or in a securely enclosed and locked pen. State law also requires the owners of a dangerous dog to take out an insurance policy for at least $100,000 to settle any future claims of injury by the dog. With advice from Phyllis Tower, the animal control officer, the state board specified a 6-foot-high fence with a slanted overhang as the required enclosure in this case. The bottom of the fence must be buried 2 feet deep to prevent the dog from digging its way out. Other requirements specified by the board include a warning sign on the fence, a lock on any gate, and further behavioral training for Ranger. The select board is to receive a report on those measures in 30 days with follow-up reports after 3 months and 6 months. Now let's listen to a public service announcement, and then I'll be back with more news.
Would you like to hear news from Shrewsbury, Northborough, Southborough, and Westborough that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Tuesday at 4 p.m.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:30. I'm going to continue with the Harvard Press. Pond water level drawdowns, rainfall concerns surface at Conservation Commission meeting, by Chris Jones. The low water level at Bear Hill Pond has garnered attention this spring, and at a well-attended June 25th Conservation Commission meeting, Bear Hill Pond Watershed Management Committee Chair Bruce Leiker voted the committee and the public, updated the committee and the public on the state of the pond in a 10-minute slide presentation. According to Leiker, an unusually dry spring with below normal rainfall is responsible for the pond's current level. After the presentation, Conservation Commission Chair Jim Burns set aside 20 minutes for public comment. Almost every speaker thanked the pond committee for their efforts, but some questioned the fall drawdown, especially this past fall when the region was in a level 2 or significant drought. Resident Adam Hughes said, "I would never stop the drawdown, but the weeds I'm seeing in May and an inability to put in boats and enjoy the pond matter a lot. So I think we would be at least a foot higher with no drawdown. I'm not going to say we wouldn't be low, but that's my opinion." In a prepared statement, Brett Fairbanks supported drawdowns and believed that they benefit the health of the pond, but was concerned that the committee's thinking might be becoming stagnant. "My hope is that future drawdown decisions incorporate not only the historical record, but also site-specific hydrological information, such as groundwater measurements, recharge conditions, and other local observations," he said. Gary Baer of Clinton Shores Drive agreed with Fairbanks and cited climate change as a reason for the pond committee to adopt a flexible strategy going forward. And what you've seen other people do on the other lakes is manage with an all-of-the-above strategy. So when we're in drought years, we cut back on our drawdowns. We all know long-term we're going to need dredging. And some lakes have actually relied on herbicides, right? There's no one tool in global warming that's going to help us. In addition, in the June 19th edition of the Press, a letter to the editor questioned the pond committee's drawdown strategy. The author proposed a modified 40-inch drawdown as opposed to the standard 6.5 feet, which, according to his calculations, would have left the pond full this spring. "The concern over the pond drawdowns appears real, so why does the town continue to practice, and could practice, be responsible for this year's low water levels?" In Massachusetts, drawdowns are heavily regulated, and they must be permitted through local conservation commissions, which, in fact, did happen last year in Harvard. According to Leiker, the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, EEA, doesn't like drawdowns unless they benefit local wildlife and ecosystems. And that's what the Bear Hill Pond drawdown is designed to accomplish. For close to 20 years, drawdowns at the pond have successfully controlled invasive weed populations as well as phosphorus levels, which can lead to summer algal blooms. According to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, algal blooms release potent toxins which can make recreation activities such as swimming unsafe for people and pets. The pond committee has carefully tracked the effects of drawdowns on Bear Hill Pond and has healthy amounts of data to support the drawdown's efficacy. In fact, when the pond's pumping station broke in 2023, which prevented the full 6.5-foot drawdown, the results were noticeable. Rainier Park and Pablo Carbonell, both pond committee members, had this to say in the June 19th issue of the Press. When the pump broke in 2023 and again in 2024, the town could only pull the boards for a shallow 3-foot drawdown, and the weeds came back with a vengeance. This past year, the pump worked. The cold reached the exposed pond bottom, and the weeds appeared to be knocked back, they wrote. Harbor Master Ben Barron agreed, "If we do less than the 6.5-foot drawdown, then there is more water for the weeds to stay alive in. Why would we want that?" At 87 Air Road, from gravestone slate to Macintosh apples to conservation land, by Carlene Phillips. The property at 87 Air Road, which was recently purchased by the Harvard Conservation Trust and is now called the Farwell Quarry, has a varied history as the longtime home of a stonecutter and then an orchardist. A list of deeds for the property adjacent to the old Pin Hill Blue Slate Quarry shows that David Kendall was living there in 1796 and sold it to Asa Warner. In 1816, Luther Farwell, a stonecutter, bought the property. Years later, in 1840, Farwell purchased the Pin Hill Slate Quarry that abutted his property. If it is true, as rumor has it, that the seller of the recently demolished house at 87 Air Road has many unfinished gravestones, those slate slabs may well be mistakes discarded by Farwell. According to Henry Norse's History of Harvard, the blue slate of Pin Hill was quarried for gravestone slabs very early in the history of the memorials in the Center Cemetery, probably came from there. The oldest memorial stone is that of Ebenezer Davis, dated May 1735. As well, quarried slate was sold to surrounding towns. The slabs were detached from the ledge by splitting them away with wedges, and the slate was then transported to a stone cutter's yard to be skillfully shaped and finished. Farwell was among several other stone cutters in Harvard, Lancaster, and Groton. One name listed by Norse as an early artisan is Enoch Kendall, who may have been a relative of the Kendall listed first on the deed of the 87 Air Road house. In 1819, the memorial stone industry is mentioned in town records when the town authorized an expansion of the quarry to the north. Norse describes how some of the workmen kept in stock a collection of sample head and foot stones in various sizes set up in a grim row by the roadside to attract customers. About 1842, the firm of Winslow, Folsom and Company of Lowell proposed to revolutionize the process of quarrying and create a more lucrative industry. They used blasting powder, but when the thousands of tons of slate thrown from the side of the hill shattered, rendering the stone useless, the company was forced to conclude that the old-fashioned way was better and cheaper, and they abandoned the project. Isaac N. Stone continued the manufacture of slate until 1863. By that time, marble and granite had become the fashion in mortuary monuments, and the quarry fell into disuse. Engraving on the early slate gravestones was relatively simple, with inscriptions in capital letters of plainest print. Occasionally, there was a death's head in low relief. After the mid-1700s, Stones were larger, the lettering more elaborative, and winged cherubs replaced the death's head. In the last quarter of the 18th century, the cherub was still popular, but a draped urn was coming into use. Epitaphs became more elaborate. After 1800, a weeping willow was a popular image of grieving. By the mid-1800s, the more popular granite obelisks or elaborate marble monuments in the cemetery stood in stark contrast to the early low memorials of native slate and simple design. In 1889, Farwell's estate sold the property to Edwin F. Houghton, a descendant of Simon Willard, settler of Harvard in the 17th century. Houghton was one of the pioneers of cultivating Macintosh apples, and he set out 150 trees. Some thought him foolish because the fruit was susceptible to scab, but by 1919 he had a highly lucrative business. In addition to the monetary success of the orchard, it was popular because of the Houghton Special. This was a car with oak wheels that carried the fruit downhill to the barn on a railroad built of wooden 2x4s. According to orchardist Frank Abbott, in an essay appearing in History of Harvard, Enter the New Century 1880 to 1940, everyone in town was reported to have had a ride in it, including all the school teachers. On one occasion, the car got out of control and went through the wall of the barn, but no injuries or serious damage resulted. In 1939, Houghton sold the property to Donald Phelps, who was related to the Houghton line. 30 years and several short-time owners later, Kenneth Van Wormer purchased the house. An undated real estate ad, most likely from sometime shortly before 1969, describes the property as having 29 pristine acres of gardens and lawns with a brook and small pond. The restorable house had 14 rooms with original doors and hardware and 7 fireplaces. A 20th century addition had created extra bedroom space. There was a 900-square-foot guest cottage, a 4-bay carriage shed, and a freestall barn. In recent years, residents driving by have watched the once stately White House deteriorate, collapsing on itself bit by bit. It became unsafe to enter, and the new owner, HCT, hired a company certified to deal with hazardous material to demolish the main house and other buildings. The huge center chimney with smoke chambers is the only thing standing. Doucette tapped for assistant town administrator HR director job by Valerie Hurley. Longtime town hall employee Julie Doucette has been promoted to the position of assistant town administrator and human resources director, assuming the dual role July 1st. Doucette fills the job vacated by Dawn Dunbar, who was hired last week as town administrator by the select board after serving as interim administrator since February. "We make a good team," Dunbar told the press, describing Doucette as deserving of a rise in the ranks. "She is diligent, hardworking, and pays attention to the details," Dunbar said. Select Board Chair Susan Mary Redinger echoed Dunbar's praise. "Julie, you are the backbone of Harvard's daily operations," Redinger told Doucette after her promotion was announced at the board's June 30th meeting. She added, "With Julie's knowledge of town operations and Dawn's solid leadership and communication skills, they make a strong, dynamic team, which is exactly what Harvard needs to meet the challenges that lie ahead." as the public face of the town's administrator's office, and a 21-year town employee, Doucette has had a head start in learning her new roles as administrative assistant to the Office of Town Administrator and the Select Board. She has long served as the point of control for both residents and for town volunteers. A lot of people are already familiar with me. Everyone comes to this office with questions. The greatest challenge, she said, will be in managing the Human Resources Department, which involves overseeing benefits for both town and school employees. Shifting responsibilities between all three jobs in the administrator's office will also take time. Because I do so much in this role, she said, particularly with managing the website and town volunteers and handling licensing and scheduling for events. The search for a new administrative assistant began this week. In other staffing news, at the June 30th meeting, Redinger announced that the board had agreed to terms of employment with Dunbar, who signed a contract, renewable after the first 3 years, at an annual salary of $185,000. The contract stipulates yearly performance reviews and a public meeting. And now let's listen to another public service announcement.
Are you or a loved one experiencing vision loss? Unable to read your daily newspapers? Feeling isolated because of blindness? If the answer is yes, Audio Journal can help. Live broadcasts of newspapers and other local publications enable blind, visually impaired, and print-disabled residents of Worcester County to connect with their communities. Newspaper readings, informative programming, education, and entertainment return you to the printed word your vision loss has denied you. For information about Audio Journal's free service, call 508-797-1117. Again, the number is 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org or go to our website at www.audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:47. I've got another couple articles from the Harvard Press. Need for recall provision tops changes sought for town charter, by John Osborne. Harvard's town charter has no way to remove an elected official who has lost the public's confidence. That gap and several other issues are before a 9-member review committee working toward proposed changes for the town meeting in the spring of 2027. Newly appointed town administrator Dawn Dunbar brought a written critique to the committee's 7th meeting last Thursday, walking members through ambiguous language, inconsistent provisions, and at least one instance in which current practice contradicts the charter. Responses to the committee's community survey and the committee's own research pointed to the same concerns. The issues drawing the most attention included the absence of any recall provision for elected officials, the line between select board policy and the town administrator's day-to-day authority, the structure of town meeting, and inconsistent language governing the appointment and confirmation of department heads. The Harvard Charter exists because Massachusetts law gives towns the right to create one, a right granted only in 1966 when voters approved the Home Rule Amendment to the state constitution. Before then, any city or town wanting to change the structure of its government had to petition the Massachusetts legislature for a special act. The arrangement benefited neither side. Towns went to Beacon Hill as supplicants to changes that were purely local matters, and the legislature fielded a stream of petitions that had little to do with state policy. A charter provides the legal framework for town governance. It defines who holds what authority, how officials are appointed and removed, and what the town meeting can and cannot do, and where the line falls between the elected board that sets policy and the administrator who carries it out. Harvard adopted its first charter in 2018. The document requires a review every 10 years. The Charter Review Committee, convened by the Select Board at the end of 2025, is conducting the first. The charter is direct on the Select Board's limits. Section 3-2C states that nothing in this section shall be construed to authorize any member of the Select Board, nor a majority of its members, to become involved in the day-to-day administration of any town agency. The committee has been hearing, through its community survey and from committee member Bruce Leicher, that the prohibition hasn't held. Leicher told the June 25th meeting that the charter contains what he called intentionally compromised ambiguities in the relationship between the Select Board and the town administrator. Residents who responded to the committee's surveys were pointed about the consequences. The Select Board needs to let the TA manage town employees and go through the TA should there be a need to address an issue with an employee, one survey respondent wrote. The Select Board should not circumvent the TA and speak with the employee directly. Several respondents connected the concern to the departure of former town administrator Dan Nason, who left after less than 2 years in office, inferring without evidence that board interference had contributed to his decision. Committee Chair Eric Ward and Dunbar read the record differently. Ward said Section 3-2C is clear on its face, but that other provisions, purchasing and hiring in particular, muddy the line. His prescription is to add supporting text, not a rewrite. A charter will never cover everything, he wrote in response to questions from the press. How we handle the spaces in between is a matter of agreement and discipline between parties. Dunbar, who was hired by Nason and worked with him until his resignation in February, said she has not experienced board interference. As long as the board is kept in the loop, that's all they want and all they need, she said. Ward said the committee has not specifically discussed Nason's departure and that board interference was not something that came through as something to be addressed in the feedback we received from our current town administrator. But it was the charter's silence on recall that drew the sharpest response in the community survey, energized by the case of former Select Board member Don Ludwig. He was chair of the Select Board when residents drew attention to remarks he had posted on X, the social media platform, which many considered inappropriate for a town official. The board censured him, and he resigned the chairmanship, but he remained on the board despite his colleagues' wishes, participating in meetings until his term expired in May. He ran for another term and lost. Article 7 of Harvard's charter addresses removal only for appointed officers and volunteers. A felony conviction triggers automatic disqualification under state law, but the charter offers nothing between that threshold and the next election. Leicher and his committee member, Pablo Carbonell, had surveyed how neighboring towns handle recalls. They reported that most require a signed affidavit under penalty of perjury stating the specific grounds for removal, followed by a petition signed by 15 to 20% of registered voters. The recall vote and a replacement candidate election appear on the same ballot. Dunbar noted that Groton's charter includes a recall provision. It should be a tough process, she said, but definitely needed. Susan Mary Redinger, who chairs the Harvard Select Board and serves on the review committee, said recall will be one of the things I think we have to wrestle with. But a recall provision is not at the top of Dunbar's list. She told the press in a Tuesday interview that the change she would most like to see is a move to two annual town meetings, a spring session for financial articles and a fall session for zoning. Shorter, more focused meetings could draw more residents, she said. The charter now mandates one annual meeting any time between February and June. Dunbar would also like to see a fixed date for town election, one not determined by the date of annual town meeting. Survey respondents called for remote voting options for town meeting, a higher quorum than the current 50 voters, and speaker time limits. The committee plans to invite town council to its July 16th meeting to provide guidance on which changes are legally within reach. Following the June 25th meeting, the select board voted to approve Dunbar's employment contract, which requires annual performance reviews presented in a public session. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Bob Brady. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Redwood forests attract millions of visitors every year. Unfortunately, the food left behind by people brings trouble for wildlife. Marbled murrelets are secretive little birds that spend most of their lives at sea, but they breed in the redwoods. Thick, moss-covered branches are like ready-made nests for the murrelet's single egg. After hatching, the chick's speckled down keeps her camouflaged in the canopy, while both parents fetch fish to feed her. Much of the marbled murrelet's historic range has been destroyed by logging and wildfires. And while North America's remaining redwood forests are protected public lands, predators are moving in. Steller's jays and common ravens are just two opportunists that thrive on our food scraps. And once they've eaten our leftover trail mix, their next meal may be a murrelet egg or chick. The Keep It Crumb Clean campaign is a state park initiative that's educating people about the importance of leaving no food unattended. That means storing food in secure containers, disposing of waste in animal-proof bins, and cleaning up all food, even crumbs. Bird Note has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more and join us at birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.